Welcome to Grand Wire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This year in review episode of Grand Wire is produced by the National Coordination Team. I am your host, Yaffa, from CKUT in Montreal, broadcasting from unceded Mohawk territories. In this episode, we review stories from the year 2017. First up, Ome brings us this review of the headlines.
The Black Lives Matter Toronto movement was born in November 2014 and spread to the rest of the country, demanding justice and dignity for Black peoples. 2017 continued to see the important work of this group and movement with the removal of police officers from Toronto schools, the resistance to deportations, and many more significant struggles. Grand Wire has continued its coverage of the movement for Black Lives in 2017. Here is some of what we brought you over the past year.
Our next headline reports on a Black Lives Matter action that took to the streets of Toronto.
Demanding a home in Canada for Beverly Bram, Black Lives Matter Toronto occupied during rush hour Yonge and Bloor, one of the city's busiest intersections. Bram, a Jamaican woman, is an immigration detainee, mother and wife to Canadian citizens. Currently in a sponsorship process with Immigration Canada, Bram and her young child were recently detained and her deportation booked. Regarding Bram's case, Black Lives Matter activists point to a history of bias and racism within Canada's immigration system. According to the press release issued by the group, on the day of the intersection occupation, Beverly Bram must stay because, quote, Black families matter. Letters of support are being mobilized by Black Lives Matter Toronto. Check out their Facebook page for more information.
CKUT's Amanla Radio files this headline with Mustafa Hanaway, reporting from a protest held on October 1st in Montreal by Guinean refugees fighting against their deportation.
We're here today to support and stand in solidarity with a group of Guinean refugees who've been fighting against their deportation back to Guinea, and with their own committee, the Guinean Committee for Status. It's very clear that the situation in Guinea as a country, as a state, despite its transition to democracy, is still tarnished with violence against those who are taking to the streets, who are protesting in Guinea for a better life. Guinea as a country, and this is reminiscent, this is very much the same as other countries that have become completely dependent on resource extraction as the main engine of their economy, still dependent to their old colonies or to countries like Canada. So it's clear that our country, our government, our state has a responsibility to not deport Guinean refugees, because Canada's profited and directly implicated in sort of the underdevelopment of Guinea.
Black Lives Matter Toronto crossed out one of their demands this week, calling for the divestment and defunding of the School Resource Officer Program. The SRO program brought officers with guns into Toronto schools. After a consultation process that included students, families, and community views on the SRO program, the Toronto District School Board's report on the program said it should end. The SRO program was removed by a vote at the Toronto District School Board's meeting held in late November. The Latinx Afro-Latin American Abya Yala Education Network, who mobilized to witness the vote, brings Ground Wire this audio from the Toronto District School Board's vote to end the School Resource Officer Program.
And for those reasons, I will be voting for the recommendation this evening.
All right. Thank you very much, Trustee Lister. Trustee Lister is the last speaker on the list. So I am going to call the question at this point. It has been asked for a recorded vote. Opposed, we have Trustees Lalka, Gershon, and Tonks.
Not to be re-elected.
That motion is carried.
Exactly. According to Black Lives Matter Toronto, who hosted a press conference after the vote, the program's removal will create a safer environment for students.
You are still listening to Groundwire, grassroots news from coast to coast to coast. Our first feature from 2017 comes from Ottawa, where Indigenous activists and their supporters converged around July 1st to counter Canada's 150 celebration events.
Arrests on Parliament took place on the eve of July 1st as Indigenous ceremony countered Canada 150 events in Ottawa. Groundwire brings you this feature with audio files from Greg McDougall.
A number of people were arrested on Parliament Hill on the eve of Canada 150 events. Organizers and participants were part of an Indigenous-led peaceful ceremony marking the first day the reoccupation events in Ottawa to counter Canada's 150th anniversary celebrations. Skulden Chronicles reports on the arrests as they happened.
This grandmother and grandfather teachings have a right to be here just like your church. This is my church. I want my spirituality to be respected on my homeland of Fertile Island.
Who are you hearing right now?
We have a constitutional right. Freedom of religion.
One of the organizers of the reoccupation ceremony.
They've
carried away about 5 to 8 people.
To be heard.
Moments
to
ago,
be
we just heard
a human being
people
out of my own homeland.
Screaming and crying because police are hurting them.
The government of Canada, Canadian colonial crown corporation, is blocking us from bringing our tepee in. You are a guest on our homeland. I'm asking you to behave in a respectful way. We are here by Creator's law. By Creator's law, we are here. You're criminalizing us for practicing our sacred ways. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Minister Carolyn Bennett, Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould, we're calling you to come down here and call off your goons. Call off your goons. They're violating our rights.
They're taking people involved in ceremony away. They are taking people who are involved in ceremony. They are taking them away.
Rotating. If we have to be here all night, then we'll be here all night. Those police officers, you can send your family members here. You can send your children here to come and help us. But we're not going anywhere. Your churches are right here. Your government is right here. But long before you were here, we were here. And we're not going to leave. So I'm asking all of you, ask your friends to come down here, and we're rotating to carry those poles.
So, if you can make it out, we have the line of TV poles propped up against the gated Parliament Hill. And to give you a little bit of history, Parliament Hill was built on, well, obviously Indian land, but before it was Parliament, they actually dispossessed Algonquin Anishinaabe from this territory where there was a whole village, a whole city, if you will, to build Parliament. And even though in 2017, there's many, many people that like to acknowledge that we are on unsurrendered, unceded Algonquin territory, there's no substance to it, as you can see now. That they don't let us proceed with our ceremonies over a permit. That's their orders. is to stop this because there's not a permit. So, as we can see here, some random permit precedes Indigenous rights. That's R-I-T-E-S and R-I-G-H-T-S. And what we're doing here is trying to assert our self-determination, our sovereignties, as laid out in the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People.
Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for news from the ground up. Available online at www.groundwirenews.ca and airing on your community radio stations. Our next feature from the year 2017 is from CJSF and covers actions against racism and white supremacy.
Vancouverites like to think of their city as diverse, inclusive, and progressive, immune to racism, homophobia, misogyny, and other forms of intolerance. In the wake of deadly clashes between white supremacists and counter-protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia, though, a rally was organized by the World Coalition Against Islam Canada and the Cultural Action Party, planned to be held in front of Vancouver's City Hall on August 19th. The event was met with strong local opposition, as thousands of Vancouverites showed up to a counter-protest in the same location.
When I say Muslim, you say sisters! Muslim!
Sisters!
Muslim!
Sisters!
And I say stand up!
The enormous crowd of protesters was addressed by several speakers, who discussed Islamophobia, the hypocrisy of anti-immigrant rhetoric, and the colonial history of Vancouver and the unceded Coast Salish, Musqueam, Kwikwetlem, and Tsleil-Waututh territories it occupies. Jesse Kaur is the founder of the Kaur Project, which celebrates diversity and inclusivity within the South Asian community. She described the frustrations minority Canadians experience daily when confronted with racism, prejudice, and the silence of white allies in the face of these challenges.
They place us in positions where we have to defend our humanity. They say there are many sides, like we're doing something to them by hurting. They say to be grateful and stop complaining, like they gave us what we have out of kindness. As a woman of color, I have every right to be terrified and outraged by white people who continue to silence my voice. People of color are terrified for ourselves, our families, and our communities. I'm outraged by the daily microaggressions I encounter. I'm outraged by the status quo, outraged by systemic racism. I'm outraged by white apathy. If it isn't clear, I will make it clear. Dismantling white supremacy has to be the work of white people. Stop acting surprised. Wake up. Listen. Learn. Invest.
Families from the unceded territories of the Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Musqueam peoples were invited to give traditional welcomes at the rally. Christy Lee Charles of the Musqueam Nation spoke of her duty to defend the land for future generations.
My name is Kahlia, and I come from Musqueam. I have lineage to Squamish, and I have lineage to Tsleil-Waututh. I come from the lineage of Kayapalano. Kayapalano is the great warrior who danced across the canoes and said, "I am not afraid, I am not afraid, I'm a warrior for my people." My great-great-grandfather, Hualsimuc, he is the one who met the Spanish explorers at Point Grey. His picture hangs in this governance house. He is the first documented citizen of the city of Vancouver. I'm here protecting my land on behalf of my children, my great-grandchildren, my grandchildren, and all the generations who are to come. Because this is who we are. We're love, not so much the Shkwalowins. That's one common saying you're going to hear across Coast Salish territory. We are of one heart and one mind.
While the size of the gathering was an encouraging show of support for diversity and equality, speakers like Ren Winona of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation made sure to remind attendees of the structural racism embedded in Canadian society, and that it takes more than attending an occasional protest to achieve equality.
Yes. Where was our support for murdered and missing Indigenous women? How many women did it take to die? One white woman is killed by her own people, and there's outrage. And it pisses me off. Because you're on my stolen land, implemented by policies that were created by racist white men. The rape of children and women and the displacement of men in their communities is what colonization is founded on. Now I'm going to a school listening to professors from all over the world who are very prestigious saying we shouldn't be buying our land back. But let me tell you something, Tsleil-Waututh is buying land back, Musqueam's buying land back, and city councillors are now learning our languages.
While Vancouverites sent a clear message by showing up in the thousands to protest the World Council Against Islam's rally, the very necessity of the counter-protest exposes a dark undercurrent of racism and prejudice most Canadians would prefer to believe didn't exist in their community. The fight for equality and human rights for all starts at home and includes questioning the larger societal structures that perpetuate and enshrine racism, white supremacy, and colonialism across Canada today. From the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem nations, for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, I'm Jesse Wensloff.
Thanks to CJSF for filing that report for Groundwire.
You are still listening to Groundwire. In August of 2017, CKOW filed this report.
In late August, thousands of residents from three Manitoba First Nations communities threatened by raging wildfires were hastily flown from their homes to larger centers in Brandon and Winnipeg. The move to makeshift shelters has generated hardship for these northern visitors and has community leaders outraged at government's response to the crisis. Michael Welch of community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg brings us this feature on the plight of these evacuees.
By the end of August, emergency officials evacuated about 3,700 members of the Garden Hill, St. Teresa Point, and Wasagamac First Nations to protect them from a raging wildfire. The trip involved traveling over water to an island with an airstrip to wait hungry and cold for airplanes of limited availability before being flown to havens in the larger centers of Brandon and Winnipeg. The shelter spaces in Winnipeg were the RBC Convention Center and a soccer complex 10 kilometers away. The venues provided little in the way of creature comforts, privacy, or even proper bathroom facilities, leaving the visitors from these isolated communities increasingly on edge.
I'm Judy Clossom. I'm the MLA for Q8. I'm from St. Teresa Point First Nation. They were cold. They had been shuffled throughout the night. They had been waiting for their planes all through the day, only to come and be put into a place where it was still cold, not enough blankets, not enough food. We ran out of food by midnight. And so it was our own chief and councils that went to go buy groceries, went to go buy food, and we started feeding everybody in the line. It was just saddening to see these elders sitting in these lineups.
Dino Flett is chief of Garden Hill First Nation, one of the evacuated communities. On Thursday, September 7th, he took part in a march to the Manitoba legislature aimed at forcing the government to declare a state of emergency, which he argues would bulk up the firefighting effort.
We want to go home. We want somebody to fight these fires and so we can go home early. I mean, it's September. Kids were supposed to be in school already. And we want our kids to be educated as much as we can. We don't want them to lose any days from this. And we just want to go home.
Every day, you know, there's still an eight-month-old baby at the RBC Center. Mother with four kids, and all her kids have bad colds. You know, they need a room. They need proper accommodations. We want to put our people in hotels with proper accommodations.
Any hotel, you can get a booking. But as soon as you say it's for a Red Cross evacuee, then, oh, no, sorry. We wanted a call of a state of emergency so that way the government could utilize any resource it needed to help the displaced people. That would have allowed our people to go into hotel rooms.
I'm Gaylene Wood, and I'm from Garden Hill. It's tiring, and we want home-cooked meals because the kids don't really eat whatever's being served.
Looking at the mother straight in the eye, who's got tears in her eyes and wants to get her children safe. Her children are running all over the place. You can see the exhaustion in her eyes. And this person, this voice on the other end of the line, is not letting you help this mother, this young mother, or this elder. And that's the inhumanity of it all.
Judy Clausen believes the crisis could have been averted in the first place if local leaders had been respected by emergency officials.
If they had listened to our leadership of Wasagamat First Nation, none of this would have happened. The fire was small enough that had they sent some water bombers in right from the start, that fire would have been under control. It was just heartbreaking to see. Although everybody was safe from the fire, they weren't safe where we were putting them because it was so cold.
As of Thursday, September 7th, the RBC shelter has been closed to the evacuees, and community leaders like Clausen and Chief Flett are continuing in their efforts to track down adequate lodgings for these strangers in this strange land, hundreds of kilometers from where they call home. From Winnipeg, on the occupied territory of the Anishinaabe and the homeland of the Métis Nation, this is CQUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
That's it for the features. We'll be right back after this.
We are the tribe that they cannot see. We live on an industrial reservation. We are the Halusa Nation. We have been called the Indians. We have been called Native Americans. We have been called hostile. We have been called pagan. We have been called militant. We have been called many names. We are the Halusa Nation. We are the human beings. The callers of names cannot see us, but we can see them. We are the Halusa Nation. Our DNA is of earth and sky.
You are just listening to We Are the Halusa Nation by A Tribe Called Red, featuring John Trudell and Northern Voices from A Tribe Called Red's 2017 album release of the same name.
Welcome back to Groundwire, your source for independent news. Now it's time for our 2017 Community Radio Report selected for this year in review edition of Groundwire.
Quebec and Canada's oldest multilingual community radio station is facing difficult times. For more than 40 years, Radio Centreville has served Montreal's diverse linguistic communities. Today, a looming debt and an accompanying crisis in governance has seen members of the community mobilizing against what they call the tyranny in Radio Centreville. Recent events have resulted in tens of programmers being blocked from accessing the airwaves and the outcomes of members' meetings being ignored by the station's board of directors. Programmers barred from the airwaves held a press conference in February about these issues and to speak out against the commercialization of the community's nonprofit airwaves.
My name is François-André Adassé-Trouillot. I'm a member of the radio station of Centreville, Radio Centreville, and specifically of the non-stop Tous les Antilles.
Your program, is it still on air today at Radio Centreville?
No, it's not.
Okay, and how long have you not been on air at Radio Centreville?
It's been about now three, four weeks. Yes, one night we came in and the door were locked and we were told that we cannot of our program.
Is this what you expected from a community radio station?
Not whatsoever.
Why is that?
Well, this is a radio station that's been around for almost 40 years, if not 40 years. Our program has been in air for 30 years. And this is a democracy here in Montreal. And most of the people, volunteers, or people that had suffered dictatorship in their countries. So they're coming here knowing that there is a democracy, a freedom of speech, and the Radio Centreville is giving that opportunity, and suddenly not having that freedom of speech because some people have decided we're no longer going to be in their own interest, that's not acceptable.
My name is Mikhail Capelas.
member of Radio Centreville since the mid-70s.
And you spoke today at a press conference held by members of Radio Centreville, and specifically about the mandate of community radio. Can you talk about how you see the mandate of community radio related to the current situation at Radio Centreville?
Well, the mandate of the community radios, you can see it in the internet site of the Association des Radios Communautaires du Québec, where you can see that the mandate of those community radios is to reinforce the participation of the citizens in the common affairs. Okay, and when we are starting selling whole hours of programming, then you destroy the nature of the community radio, because you do not allow to dozens of citizens, dozens of volunteers to participate in the community radio.
Radio Centreville has indeed been selling airtime for the last few months, and a number of volunteers in community groups have been told that they're no longer on the airwaves of the station. What has been the reaction of groups like your own, working with the Greek group at Radio Centreville? What's been the reaction from the volunteers?
Well, we tried to discuss, to talk with those who implemented those sales of programs, and there is no way to discuss, to have a dialogue with those things. They are decided to sell, and they don't have any other alternative. We propose to continue to try to find other sources of money, and they didn't do anything on that direction.
Whenever the board of the station takes decision like to sell airwaves, it was mentioned here today that the General Assembly is supposed to approve that.
That approval didn't happen, but in the General Assembly of December the 4th, there was one only decision to reject completely the sales of programming. And the board of directors refused to respect the decision of the General Assembly.
Mihiel, a Greek language broadcaster at Radio Centreville, said 32 Greek community organizations have signed a letter to denounce the programming changes imposed by the board. For programmers like Mihiel, listeners need non-commercial, independent community radio more than ever.
So if you lose the community radios, then you will have the alternate facts, fake news, and Radio Poubelle. So that's the question. Do we want as a society to have more participation of the citizens or not? And a community radio can participate to enforce that engagement of the citizens.
Groundwire will continue to follow this story, reporting for CKUT Radio in Montreal, broadcasting on Anishinaabe lands and unceded Mohawk territory. This is Gretchen King.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by the National Coordination Team in Montreal on the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe Nations. We thank all of our amazing contributors who were part of Groundwire for the year 2017.
Music this week was by A Tribe Called Red.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio stations, or download at www.groundwirenews.ca.